the Air Force Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Air Force Podcast. I'm your host, Tech Sergeant Billy O'Brien. Today, we're going to be listening to the second part of a conversation my colleagues Tech Sergeant Lance Valencia and Tech Sergeant Nick Ketz had with the first Guardian in space, Colonel Nick Haig. Although this is the first Guardian on a space mission, this is nothing new for the Department of Defense and NASA, as roughly two-thirds of NASA astronauts have served in the United States Armed Forces.
I think something that's also really unique about this trip for you, sir, is, you know, this is your second time into orbit, but this is your first time going up as a Guardian. And you get to be that flag bearer for the Space Force as the first Guardian into orbit and into space to continue to push that service, you know, into the future. What does that feel like to have that accomplishment?
You know, I feel really privileged to have the opportunity specifically to launch from the U.S. Because it gives me an opportunity to cast a broader spotlight on everything that Guardians do to make human spaceflight possible. I think the average person might not understand that human spaceflight doesn't exist if Guardians aren't doing what they do on a day-to-day basis. Whether it's launching us into space and the range support that we get there, or it's tracking or navigation, or all, I could go on and on about everything that happens, but I can tell you that if the Space Force and its Guardians and U.S. Space Command are not doing their jobs, we don't explore space. All the good that comes from human space exploration doesn't happen. And so my sole goal in this mission, if I could accomplish one thing, is to let every Guardian feel that connection to the magic that is human spaceflight.
And can you connect some of those dots for us of the Guardian to that actual spaceflight?
Yeah. Let me think of one that seems fairly routine these days. The space station is roughly 250 miles above the Earth, low Earth orbit, and it's zipping around. And there's a lot of stuff up there these days. And you know, every Starlink launch, there's more and more stuff up there. I mean, there's a lot of satellites, and then there's even more debris. And NASA doesn't track the debris, right? It's Guardians stationed around the globe that are generating that picture of the space domain and letting us know, hey, there's a potential conjunction here. And then they let us know, and they provide us that data, and then we make a judgment call. Is it coming close enough? Do we need to move out of the way? And if we need to, we move the station. And that's a fairly routine thing that we do. We reboost not just to maintain the orbit of the station. We reboost to get out of the way of debris. That, you know, whether they realize it or not, you know, they're saving our lives on a fairly routine basis. And so, you know, you've probably all seen the maps of the 50 to 60,000 things orbiting the Earth, and it looks like this cloud around the Earth. Well, there's a few of those dots that have people living on them, and you know, one of them has been continually inhabited for over almost 2.5 decades now, and that's only possible because of that protection that we've been afforded throughout history by Guardians.
That's awesome, sir. That's a great way to describe that. You know, that really could be like a specialist in the Space Force, you know, telling you that, hey, there might be a piece of debris and to move out of the way. Something else we're a little bit curious about is, you know, the partnership with NASA. That seems like such an interesting partnership. We're taking, you know, NASA and then combining them with, you know, a you know, military service. What has that partnership been like, you know, for your career in astronautics?
Yeah, it's been fun to be part of both of those organizations and to live in that overlap. I can tell you that, you know, the missions are distinctly different. NASA has a civil space mission, and it is trying to answer the big questions of why are we here, how things work, and to push us further into space to get data to answer that and to help humanity expand into space. And you know, the Space Force mission is focused on protecting that domain. So they're complementary in that the relationship I, you know, kind of spoke about before, Space Force builds that foundation of stability, the foundation of protection, if you will, that allows NASA to do its civil space mission. They don't exist without each other in that they are complementary. And it's you know, an agreement between DOD and NASA that allows me the opportunity to be assigned to NASA and be a NASA astronaut as an active duty military member. We've got representatives from all the services as part of the Corps, and there's no requirement to have DOD astronauts. We compete, you know, we just closed this most recent application window, and I've heard that there were lots of Guardians that applied, so I've got a big smile on my face right now to be part of that next astronaut class. There's no quota. So they are, NASA really just looks at it and says, hey, we're going to pick the best people we can find. If they happen to be in the military, then we're still going to pick them. And we have agreements in place that'll still allow them to come and represent their country and be part of this amazing mission. And so it's been fun to see those two missions overlap, those two cultures overlap. And I think that, you know, a unique perspective that I have is I know there's so much that we have to learn from each other through the ways that we each have conducted our own business over the course of the years. And those best practices, if we can cross-pollinate those best practices, I think both organizations end up becoming better.
Yeah, for sure. And talking about some of those Guardians applying to be astronauts, that has got me thinking, like, for the young Guardians out there today who have that dream to be an astronaut, what would you tell them?
Yeah. You know, the first thing you can do is you can look at, well, what's it take? So the minimum requirements, you need to have a STEM master's. So you've got to get an education, you've got to get a master's degree, and it's got to be in a STEM field. You've got to have 2 years of applicable work experience after that. And then you've got to be healthy. That last one is somewhat in your control and somewhat out of your control, right? You know, genetics and things happen that may or may not medically disqualify you, but you got to stay fit. And so you got to take care of yourself physically and mentally as you go along your path. So that's the minimum requirements. So it's not a super high hurdle. Beyond that, we're really looking for people that are like these amazing teammates, because it's a team sport. And so do you participate in small teams? Do you get along with other people well? Do you know how to resolve conflict? We focus a lot on like these softer skills of interpersonal relationships and how do you foster cohesion and camaraderie amongst a team? And how do you come to, you know, conflict resolution? And so we look at that, but then we also look, hey, how do you operate in high stress environments? How do you handle time constrained problem solving? And how do you do that as part of a team? And so when I think about it, I think, you know, Guardians are in an amazing position, not only just to demonstrate the job, because the, you know, the missions are separate between NASA and the Space Force, but the skill set, operating control room, managing satellites, using all of that same technology, it's the same skill set. So working on an ops floor is the same as working in MCC. So you're demonstrating you can do the job. You work in small teams, so you've got the opportunity to hone those skills. And then just in general, the military affords you so many opportunities to expand and push yourself into these austere, remote, challenging environments to further develop your ability to operate in those, you know, time-constrained, high-pressure, high-risk kind of activities. So I think Guardians, you know, if they put their mind to it, they've got all the tools at the ready to be able to work toward that goal.
That's awesome to hear. I think that really puts a lot of like an interesting perspective to it. I think for a lot of us, you know, when we hear like, oh, you're an astronaut, you're like, wow, I could never be an astronaut. That sounds like a hurdle that I would never be able to get over. But the way that you explain that, that does make it seem like, you know, if you really put your mind to it and you know, things can work out your way, you could be, you know, an astronaut. I think what we kind of want to do now is we're going to just shift a couple of the questions more towards, you know, while you're in space. We were thinking about a couple of these. And I think these some of these questions are a little more of the gee whiz when Lance and I sat down to kind of talk about them. We're like, man, you know, what are some of these questions that, like, if we could just talk to an astronaut for a couple of minutes, you know, what would you ask? And I think one of them for me is, you know, obviously the meal situation up there is a little bit different because of how, you know, from what I've read and seen and how you guys receive your meals in space. Is there ever a time that you've been on the ground that you're like kind of excited to get back into space because there's like a certain space meal that you missed? Or is it just like, you know what, while we're there, it's great, but happy to be back with regular food?
You know, I am, again, I'm one voice out of the astronaut corps, so you may have different opinions. I think astronauts are like doctors. If you've got three of them together, you might have 10 different opinions. So I've, you know, I've deployed, I've had to eat MREs, and when I get home, I don't necessarily get a hankering for MREs.
Yeah. Is there like a certain condiment that it like is like the thing while you're up there? Like everybody's like, oh, I gotta have that. Otherwise we're not surviving for the 7 months we're up here.
It ebbs and flows. And so, you know, just to describe the menu to you a little bit. So some of the things that we have up there are taken straight out of the MRE portfolio that's on the ground. Other stuff is added to it. So we end up with about 200 different meal items. And we work with nutritionists to make sure that it's fairly balanced. Some of it is irradiated, some of it, so you just warm it up. Some of it is dehydrated, so you have to add water and let it rehydrate. Some of it is just vacuum sealed. So, you know, you can get a, you know, if you wanted a package of peanuts, you know, there's vacuum sealed peanuts up there. So there's great variety. And then you also have the ability to kind of swap with some of the international. So the Russians have their own food. And so we'll, hey, I'm going to give you some of mine. You give me some of yours. And so you can continue to expand that variety. But the things that are in low commodity or become the cherished things are the ones that everybody likes. And your taste kind of changes up there. There's all kinds of different explanations. I'm not sure anybody really knows. So when you get up on orbit, when you're on the ground, let's start with on the ground. When you're on the ground, your heart is pumping and it's trying to overcome gravity. So it pushes blood harder to your head than it does your feet. When you get on orbit, your heart doesn't know you're on orbit. And so it keeps pumping blood harder to your head than your feet. And so the pressure in your head goes up more than you're used to. And so it feels like you've got a head cold. And your body adapts to it a little bit, but in general, I felt like I always had a little bit of sinus congestion up there, just that extra pressure in my head. And then, you know, you think about a head cold, you get a sinus, you know, all that stuff's in there. It kind of mutes your sense of taste. And so people will say that you know, you kind of have this muted sense of taste up there. So something that traditionally is in hot commodity are any kind of hot sauces where you can add a little more kick to the food because it gets bland over time. So sriracha sauce, Tabasco sauce, Cholula, you know, any of that stuff, we can get up there and you just, you know, douse it on to your heart's content until it runs out. And if everybody's doing it, it runs out fast.
What is your go-to hot sauce?
I'm just curious.
Go-to hot sauce. You know, in general, it's up there. It was sriracha sauce because that's what we had. Down here, a little bit of Tabasco, but typically I'm not putting a whole lot of hot sauce on because I'm just adding, I'm just adding like grilled peppers to things, you know, give me a habanero, or, you know, let's grill out some poblanos and, you know, chop that stuff up and put it in. You just can't do that up there. So we resort to instant heat.
Instant heat. While you're up there too, I don't know if it's changed. I think the last like big documentary I had seen, was from a while ago from one of the Canadian astronauts on, you know, communicating with home. You know, do you get to call home a lot? Like, is there, you know, can you FaceTime? Is it just email, phone calls? Is it a radio that you have to use? Like how do you keep in touch with the family back here on Earth while you're up there?
You have amazing connectivity to your family. So I have, there's a constellation of satellites that sit up in GEO called TDRS. That's our NASA's tracking and relay satellites. And so we have almost like a 90 to 95% constant contact with that. And so we've got, you know, S-band and we've, so the ability to talk and to stream video is just beyond what. So I first deployed to Iraq back in 2003 and was having to, you know, get my sporadic once a week kind of phone call at the, you know, the queue in the tent. And when I think about that and the amount of separation there was during that type of deployment, and now when I can get on my computer, I've got a you know, dedicated link. I can dial up an IP phone and call home pretty much anytime I want to and check in at home. And the delay on the communications is almost imperceptible. It's pretty amazing. And then each weekend, we'll set up dedicated times to do video conferences with the family. So that's just like doing, you know, Zoom or Skype or FaceTime. And it's real time back and forth. You can stay. My wife complained that I called her more from orbit than I did while I was in training. And basically she said, you know, stop calling so much. We've got stuff to do down here.
Oh, that's good. And do y'all have like any family traditions that y'all do like while you're up there and that you plan to keep doing, you know, as ways to, you know, just to feel close, because calling's good. But are there anything that y'all are doing, like I said, that helps y'all, helps you feel closer to home?
Yeah. You know, so little things to help mark the passage of time. We get care packages. So the family has the ability to send stuff up, and I've got very limited ability to send stuff down, and there's usually a very long lead time associated with that. So that's, you know, maybe once or twice during the time that I'm up there, there'll be an opportunity to pass a note and send it down, or to have them send up something. You know, I remember getting a package of Christmas cards from all of my relatives, and so I was able to open Christmas cards. We did some little things. So I had, my boys are bigger now. They're still not out of high school, but, they were littler the last time around 5 years ago. And so one of the things we did to help mark the passage of time is before I left, I gave them, the Millennium Falcon Lego set, that really big one that's got like 7,500 pieces. And I said, okay, start building it the day I leave and let's see if you can get done before I get back. And so then they would just share the progress as they were going, snap pictures and tell me about how it was going. And when I got back, they had saved the antenna dish to stick on top of it, but it was done. So you find ways to connect. But, you know, in some regards, it's like any military deployment that you're going to be part of, you know, back home, they've got their lives to live. And you know, I think my wife, you know, although she was joking somewhat, she was pretty spot on in that, you know, hey, you've got your mission to do, we've got our mission to do, and we'll stay in sync and we'll stay in touch so we know how we're doing. But we're going to do those things and then we'll reintegrate when you get back here. And then you can tell us all about it.
Oh man, yeah, what a rock star of a spouse right there.
Sure.
That is amazing. You know, and that has kind of got me thinking, earlier you were speaking about, you know, the amount of camaraderie and teammanship that they're looking for, NASA's looking for when deciding on who they want to be an astronaut. And knowing you have all that deployment experience coming from the military background, were you able to mentor some of your teammates in that separation and how to deal with it?
Yeah, it's a constant challenge. And I, you know, it ultimately is, how do you make yourself resilient? How do you make your family resilient? And those are things I think we tend to think about it when in the deployed setting, but those are skills and things you need to do every day, you know, whether you're separated or not. And it all starts, fundamentally, it starts with just aggressive, open, candid communication. You can never over communicate enough with your significant others. And you're always just, hey, what are our priorities? How am I feeling? And you're sharing that and you're working together. And that's just reinforcing that supportive environment. And that's the bedrock that everything gets built off of. And so as long as you're just talking to each other, then you can figure out how to get through, not only figure out how to get through things, but do it well and know that as you're going through them, you've got somebody on your wing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I got one more question before I'll pass it over to Nick to wrap this thing up. And this is just coming from the most enlisted of mindsets right now. What's that per diem like up there?
Well, okay. So if you go through per diem rules, government transportation is provided. And all government meals are provided. So believe it or not, I do file a travel voucher to low Earth orbit.
Oh, wow.
And the only thing that comes out of that travel voucher is the incidental meals and expenses daily rate. I think it's $5 a day or something like that. So that is my bonus pay for going to space. I get an extra $5 a day.
Oh, wow. That's great. Yeah, Nick, I'll pass it on to you now.
Well, sir, we definitely appreciate the time. It's always great to get a chance to sit down and chat, especially with somebody that, you know, has meant a lot, not only to the Space Force, but also to the Air Force as well. You know, you've meant a lot to the Department of the Air Force, both services. We want to wish you the absolute best of luck on your travels. We'll definitely be here watching. We're really excited for you. And we're just going to give you a chance before we sign off. You know, is there anything else that, you know, you wanted to add or something that maybe we should have asked you?
No, it's been great to chat with you guys. I'm just going to foot stomp. I want everybody to feel connected. You know, there may be only four people in a capsule launching into space, but there are massive teams on the ground that make that possible. The easy team to think about is the one in the Mission Control Center or the Launch Control Center that's actively working the rocket and the capsule or managing the space station. There's the training teams that are associated with that. And then if you open that aperture even further, and that's really what I hope everybody understands, is when you expand that circle, Guardians should find themselves inside that circle. They're connected to every one of these launches where we're sending people into space and we're discovering things that are going to benefit all of humanity. And they should feel pride in that and never feel like that something like that is out of reach.
Colonel Haig docked at the International Space Station September 29th. For the five-month mission, he will be participating in a variety of research projects for NASA's Human Research Mission. Each study is designed to help address the health challenges that astronauts may face during future long-duration missions to the Moon, Mars, and beyond.
The Air Force Podcast.